Warning, this episode contains domestic violence content. If you or anyone you know is experiencing violence from your or their domestic or intimate partner, please call 1-800-799-SAFE. Again, 1-800-799-SAFE. You can also text START to 88788 or chat with someone online at thehotline.org. The hotline runs 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year, and provides essential tools and support to help survivors of domestic violence. There will always be help and support, and please know that domestic violence is not your fault. Hey guys, I'm sorry for the late episode. It was my birthday on June 5th and I hadn't had the time to research. I do have a good case for you today and I think you will find it interesting. Before we start, I just want to mention that you can support the podcast with just $1 a month. How amazing that you care, please. Also, thanks to newspapers.com, who isn't sponsoring me, by the way, I can find the original newspaper articles that covered cases. In my brief and amazing experience using these tools, I have found more accurate information than I have found in the past. The link will be in the show notes and blog. I also got great information from a Forensic Files episode titled Perfect Match, which I will mention throughout the episode, and I will provide a link to where you can find the episode free in the show notes and blog. All right, let's get started with today's episode. A quote from CanadianWomen.org, "More than 4 in 10 women have experienced some form of intimate partner violence, or IPF, in their lifetimes, such as psychological, physical, or sexual violence. Research shows that women disproportionately experience the most severe forms of IPF, such as being choked, being assaulted, or threatened with a weapon, or being sexually assaulted. Approximately every 6 days, a woman in Canada is killed by their intimate partner. The proportion of women killed by a spouse or intimate partner is over 8 times greater than the proportion of men. There are many reasons why one won't leave an abusive relationship. In many cases, abusive partners might threaten harm or death to themselves, the victim in question, their children, or other loved ones if the victim tries to leave." Another quote from CanadianWomen.org, "The most dangerous time for an abused woman is when she attempts to leave her abuser. In cases of murder-suicides, separation is a common theme. Women are 6 times more likely to be killed by an ex-partner than by a current partner, and many women say they were abused by a partner after the relationship ended and that the violence escalated following a breakup. Almost 60% of police-reported dating violence happens after the relationship has ended." These quotes are from CanadianWomen.org, like I mentioned, which has quoted some very good journals that study domestic violence and women in Canada. I really recommend looking at this website if you or someone you know is experiencing domestic violence. And if you want to do a little bit more research about the topic, please go to all the sources that they have in CanadianWomen.org. Please let your loved ones know if you are experiencing domestic violence. Please let someone know when you are trying to leave, and please take extra precautions in your safety. I know this is easier said than done, but despite what your partner tells you, you have people that care about you and they want the very best for you. No matter what they tell you, the abuse you face is not your fault. With that in mind, I will begin the case. In October 1994, Shirley Duguay was a 32 mother of 5 who lived in Richmond, Prince Edward Island. And for those who don't know, Prince Edward Island is located in Canada west of Maine. It is one of the smallest provinces in Canada that had about 16,000 residents, and everybody knew basically everybody there. Shirley's oldest child was 15, and her youngest were 8-year-old twins. During this time, Shirley was estranged from her husband Douglas Beamish and was the father of 3 of her children. I read in multiple conflicting reports that he was her husband, but when I went to newspapers.com and looked through the older articles in 1994 and 1995, they all said that he was her boyfriend, but later archived articles said he was her former common law husband. Forensic Files also said that he was her estranged husband, so I think we're going to go with Douglas having been that. According to Forensic Files, Shirley and Douglas separated in 1993 after 15 years in an off and on relationship together. Melvin Duguay, Shirley's father, said that Douglas physically abused Shirley. Melvin tried to be a support for Shirley and begged her not to see Douglas anymore, but she always got back together with him. According to the North Bay Nugget, coming out of North Bay, Ontario, Douglas had moved to Prince Edward Island in early 1993 from Toronto, was a demolition worker, and lived with his parents and his white cat, Snowball. He also had a criminal record and was on parole at this time. On October 3, 1994, Shirley suddenly disappeared from her home. No one had reported her missing because Shirley was known to take off for a couple of days and not tell anyone where she was going. She would always return, which led to her father Melvin to look after her kids when she left. A couple of days later, on October 7th, according to the Forensic Files episode I mentioned earlier, a woman called police about an abandoned car on Highway 169 in a field near Richmond with missing license plates. When police looked inside, it was very apparent that this was a crime scene. They found small amounts of blood spatter on the windshield, the side windows, and throughout the car. According to Forensic Files, forensic scientists had identified the blood spatter as medium impact, the type that is caused when someone was hit with an object like a fist. Police also found a tiny amount of blood in the car that did not belong to Shirley, and police used the serial number of the car to identify its owner, Shirley Duguay. About 1 kilometer or less than half a mile away from the car, they discovered a t-shirt and pillow that Shirley used to drive with covered with small amounts of blood. They immediately suspected foul play. Police suspected the blood in the car, the pillow, and t-shirt belonged to Shirley and collected a blood sample from her father. And like I mentioned earlier, they found that Shirley's blood was a 50% match to Melvin's, therefore it belonged to Shirley. 150 Canadian Forces soldiers began searching the woods near Shirley's home using metal prods and 5 metal detectors. Throughout the week, they had covered more than 20 square kilometers, or about 8 miles, of woods and swampland trying to find clues to Shirley's disappearance or just Shirley herself. RCMP Sergeant Dwight Mullally said the Army was called in because the Mounties, I guess their police force, had wanted the search to be as complete as possible before snowfall. Eventually, they expanded their search and began using dogs. They didn't have a set pattern and relied on current information received by police. The police sent in several tips that came into the Army who would relay the information to the soldiers during their search. 3 days into the search, about 10 kilometers or a little over 6 miles in the woods away from Shirley's house and about 15 miles from Shirley's car, a military team found a plastic bag containing a man's leather jacket and a pair of sneakers. The items were covered in blood. The jacket was in a men's size and it was too big for Shirley. She was only 4 feet 9 inches tall and weighed about 100 pounds. Oddly enough, they also found white hairs in the lining of the jacket. Police immediately sent the items into evidence for testing of the blood and to try to identify who the hairs could belong to. They figured that the hairs were a massive clue, obviously, and that it could lead to an older gentleman somehow, maybe Douglas? The blood in the jacket did come back as a match to Shirley. The Royal Mounted Police interviewed Melvin, Shirley's father, about who could have wanted to hurt Shirley. His response, Douglas Beamish, Shirley's estranged husband. Police went to interview Douglas at his parents' house, and according to The Guardian, he gave them the impression that she just walked out on everybody's lives and that he had absolutely no idea where she went. Police asked him what size shoe he wore, and he said 9. Douglas had also denied owning the jacket and sneakers. Police had a very strong suspicion that he did have something to do with Shirley's disappearance and began testing evidence further. According to the Forensic Files episode mentioned, the sneakers found were a 9 in Douglas's size. With a warrant, police had Douglas's feet cast into styrofoam molds and poured plaster inside. Forensic scientists compared the molds to the sneakers and found that the soles had been worn in such a way that was consistent with how he walked. The pressure points in the molds matched the sneakers. His feet were pronated, meaning turned inward, which were also indicated in the sneakers. When testing the hairs found from the jacket, the hairs did not appear to belong to a human, but an animal. Investigator Roger Savoie knew that Douglas owned a white cat named Snowball and recalled that Snowball had brushed up against his leg and left white hairs that looked exactly like the hairs found in the jacket. Investigator Savoie figured he could find an expert to match the hairs found to Snowball. This proved to be very difficult because during this time, forensic testing on cat hair had never been done before anywhere in the world. He made hundreds of calls, but no one had any interest in testing the cat hairs. The investigation had stalled at this point. In April 1995, the RCMP Missing Children's Bureau began assisting in the search to find Shirley. Although this organization was for missing children, they were the only RCMP office at the national level that dealt with missing people at the time. According to the Calgary Herald, Sergeant Mullally said investigators were trying to get Shirley's story out every way they could because the case around her disappearance was so strange and sudden. He found it particularly strange that in the year she had been gone, she hadn't tried to contact her five young children or other relatives that were looking after the children. It didn't make sense that Shirley could have just left without them, without arrangements for them, and with her car abandoned and blood spattered everywhere. The jacket and sneakers proved that Shirley didn't walk away, but there wasn't any concrete evidence to prove anything. Finally, investigator Suava found Stephen O'Brien, a geneticist with the U.S. National Cancer Institute, who incidentally had spent decades studying hereditary illnesses in cats. Dr. O'Brien agreed to help look into the hairs found on the jacket. According to the Daily News, investigator Suava got a subpoena to draw a blood sample from Snowball and read the rights to Douglas's parents. He said on Forensic Files that getting the sample was difficult because Snowball kept running from him and hid under beds and couches. Finally, they were able to take Snowball to a local veterinarian hospital to collect the sample. Investigator Suava flew directly to Dr. O'Brien to deliver the blood sample and cat hair in person. He didn't want anything to happen to the samples. According to the Forensic Files episode mentioned, during testing, Dr. O'Brien found a tiny amount of flesh attached to the roots and used the DNA from the flesh to conduct the tests with the blood. Dr. O'Brien said on Forensic Files that the DNA from the flesh of the root had the same genetic markings as with the blood from Snowball. The only thing standing in the way of being able to say that the hairs conclusively belonged to Snowball was the fear that the genetic markings of the hairs could belong to another cat on Prince Edward Island. What was the frequency of the profile? According to the Forensic Files episode mentioned, Dr. O'Brien took 20 blood samples from 20 cats on the island. Despite their fears that the cats could have the same genetic profiles, the testing actually proved the opposite. Dr. O'Brien estimated that another cat on the island having the same profile to Snowball was actually about 1 in 70 million. I also read that it was 45 million to 1 in the Daily News and the Times Colonist, but the point is that the results were conclusive. The hairs on the jackets definitely belonged to Douglas's cat, Snowball. According to the province, on May 6, 1995, a trout fisherman found a body from a shallow grave in western Prince Edward Island. The body was found 15 kilometers, or a little over 9 miles away from where Shirley's car was found 7 months earlier. According to the Daily News, the body's hands had been tied behind their back and their head looked to be beaten. Investigators believe that the body belonged to Shirley Duguay. During the autopsy, the body was confirmed to belong to Shirley. Her cause of death was determined to be blunt force trauma to the head. Her nose was broken and her jaw was broken in 3 places, and one of her front teeth was found embedded in her lung. The blood spatter had matched Shirley's cause of death, which made the car the scene of the crime. Blood found from the car that didn't match Shirley's, like I mentioned earlier, had matched Douglas's. With all of this incriminating evidence, Douglas Beamish was arrested and charged with Shirley Duguay's murder. According to the Daily News, during his 8-week-long trial, a letter Douglas wrote to Shirley was presented as evidence. In the letter, he had threatened to kill Shirley before he allowed her to gain custody of his children. The 1-page letter was written and signed in blood. A picture was also brought in as evidence of Douglas wearing a similar jacket to the one found covered with cat hairs and Shirley's blood. Remember, Douglas denied owning the jacket. With the cat hairs, blood spatter in the car, Shirley's autopsy in the jacket and sneakers, Douglas Beamish was found guilty of second-degree murder of Shirley Duguay. On July 19, 1996, he was sentenced to life without parole in an Ontario prison. In August 2013, according to Saltwire.com, Douglas went to the Parole Board of Canada to be considered for full or day parole but was denied both. The board said that Douglas was not cooperating with his case management team and that his past 17 disciplinary convictions and 10 instances of refusing to give urine samples convinced them that he does not belong outside of prison. Hopefully, he never gets out. He deserves absolutely nothing in this life. What is interesting about this case is that genetic testing had only been around for 7 years at this point. Now, there are cat and dog DNA databases in Britain and the US. There have been way more advancements in genetic testing in cats and dogs, and some other crimes are being solved using the same techniques as in this case. In July 2012, according to NBC News, David Guy was found dismembered in a curtain on a beach in Hampshire, Britain. The curtain had several cat hairs, which were sent to be analyzed. A suspect in the case, David Hildler, had a cat who was tested as well. The hairs found in the curtain were a match to David's cat. Scientists were also concerned about the possibility of another cat having the same profile, so they tested around 150 cats. This proved that the profile was uncommon, and the hairs were used to charge and convict Hildler of manslaughter. The case was the first time cat DNA was used in a criminal trial in the UK. With all of this new technology, I think it will be harder for people with pets to commit crimes, especially with the cat and dog DNA databases available. What happened to Shirley was a terrible crime that was so unnecessary, but I am very glad that some good came out of it. I hope that Shirley's family and children have some peace in knowing who murdered her and that she is helping other cases being solved today. I can't possibly understand what they are going through, and I know that getting justice doesn't exactly equate peace, but I really hope they are okay and thriving at this point of time. Again, I just want to reiterate that if you or anyone you know is experiencing violence from your or their domestic or intimate partner, please call 1-800-799-SAFE. Again, 1-800-799-SAFE. There will always be help and support, and please know that domestic violence is not your fault. I hope everyone has a good rest of your week, and please stay safe out there. Thank you for listening to Crime Cloud. If you would like to access my Instagram, go to @CrimeCloudPodcast. And for my Twitter, go to @CrimeCloudPod. To find the blog, go to CrimeCloudPodcast.blog. To email suggestions or corrections, use CrimeCloudPodcast@gmail.com. Thank you again for listening and supporting the podcast. We'll be right back.